Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Archer's War by Martin Archer, narrated by Sean Grindell. Chapter 1. We could see the little village of Foy off to our left as our galley slowly rowed into the Foy estuary and finally, to my great relief, left the rough channel waters behind.
"We're almost there, Helen. Restormore Castle, your new home, is a little ways up this river. It's called the River Foy, by the way, and the little cluster of houses off to the left is Foy Village. The people eat the fish caught in the sea and the greens and such that they find in the forest. Funny people they are. They live here in England, and always have, but they speak some kind of local language no one can understand. Strange, isn't it?"
We rowed up the Foy against the current, until we reached our camp just below Restormore, where the apprentice archers have the learning put on them. Along the way, we came across two boys sitting on the grassy riverbank, with crudely fashioned fishing poles. They waved enthusiastically as we passed, and ran a few steps along the river footpath to keep up with us. Then they stopped and just stood there, looking back down the river in amazement, when they saw all the other galleys coming up behind us, and heard their rowing drums. Helen and everyone on deck gave them a friendly wave.
"Are they biting?"
someone shouted over to them. The boys smiled back, and then suddenly turned around, listened for a moment, and ran off into the woods. Someone's mother must have called. Probably Cornish squatters, since there are no farms along here, due to the periodic flooding and the use of land on this side of the river as a hunting ground for the Restormore lords, before we killed the latest of the murdering bastards and took his fief. Ah, well, they look like good lads, and we're not much into hunting, are we? It's easier to raise sheep and cattle and kill them when we're hungry. Our training and boat camp came into sight as we came around the slight bend in the river and could see it through the trees. It looked very much the same as it had when we left in the spring to sail back to the Holy Land, to earn more coins carrying refugees to safety in our galleys. The same tents and sleeping hovels for the sailors and boatwrights were there along the tree line, and the two dinghies covered with rough cut boards were still moored to the trees along the shore to act as a floating wharf. Our sailors and apprentice archers are kept busy working on the cart paths and the castle's defences when they aren't engaged in other duties and being learnt how to use longbows and pikes. Keeps them out of mischief, doesn't it? One of the two galleys we left here in Cornwall was tied to a tree growing along the riverbank, just below our floating wharf. The other galley must be off somewhere on an errand, or recently lost. The two galleys and the old cog we rowed past at the mouth of the river are used to teach our archers and pikemen how to behave and fight when they board an enemy galley, or one of the sailing ships used to transport cargoes in the waters around the Holy Land. The big cargo cogs and ships with their high sides, which are so difficult to climb aboard and capture, unless you know how. Teaching our archers and pikemen how to board an enemy boat is one of the reasons we have the old cog, and a number of sailors here, in addition to the galleys. We also have a couple of other cogs we use to move people and supplies among the ports from here to Liverpool and Newcastle, and particularly to and from London. The other cogs are usually here. I wonder where they are. Harold himself was standing in our galley's bow and threw its mooring line to a couple of ragged-looking men standing on the floating wharf. They are some of our boatwrights by the look of their clothes and the tools in their hands, and a welcome sight they are, that's for sure. Several of our galleys are badly in need of repairs. One of them leaks so severely, it's a wonder it got here at all. Apostos from Cyprus, the sergeant of our boatwrights here in Cornwall, obviously heard the cries of the men who could see and hear us coming. He was walking briskly towards the wharf, as we were mooring, with a big welcoming smile on his face, and his hand held up in a friendly greeting.
"And there is Geoffrey, the sergeant in charge of the archers' training, by God! I wonder why Geoffrey's here. Normally he's at Restormore, where we train the apprentice archers and barrack them."
Apostos and Geoffrey both got big handshakes and enthusiastic claps on their shoulders from me and Harold as we climbed over our galley's deck railing and onto the unsteady little wharf. It's good to see them again. It surely is.
Hello, Geoffrey. It's good to see you. What brings you down here with the people who have to work for their bread? Going for a sailor, are you?
My God, no, William. But it's good to see you too. And that ugly sailor with you as well. Have a good trip, did you?
Yes, we have so many Williams among our archers, we've all ended up being scribed on the company roll with a second name. William Lewis, William Farmer, William Smith, and so on and so forth. I'm the one who captains the company, so now I'm sometimes William Captain, or just William.
Middling, Geoffrey, just middling. We hit Almeria and got away with almost nothing. But then we hit Cadiz and made off with 14 Moorish galleys and a very nice cog. We sent them off to Cyprus with prize crews, didn't we? I'll tell you all about it when we have a chance to hoist a bowl together.
We talked about many things as we stood and watched as the rest of our 10 galleys came in, one after another, and tied up to the trees along the riverbank. But most of our talk was about how soon we can get as many as possible of our galleys resupplied and headed back to Cyprus. And the need to have our 2 leakers pulled ashore to be repaired, and how long it might take. And, of course, the most important question of all, at least as far as I'm concerned, how many fully trained archers do we have available to immediately send back to Cyprus with their own longbows? Yes, I know, I'll soon be having the same conversation with Thomas, but we've not a day to spare, and I want Geoffrey and everyone else to get started. We have an obligation to the merchants who have begun acting as our agents in the Holy Land ports to quickly replace the galleys we sent to Constantinople and Antioch. We've got enough galleys, of course, because of all those we took out of Cadiz a couple of weeks ago, and we can always find sailors and pilots in the ports along the way. What we're mostly missing are archers with longbows and bladed pikes who know how to fight on both land and sea, the ones we've taken to sometimes calling our Marines. I didn't have to wait to see my son and my priestly brother. There was a great hello, and here they came, hurrying down the cart path from the castle. Someone standing on the castle wall must have seen the galleys coming up the river, and they've come to greet us. And it's a right merry time when they do. George broke into a run, and was totally out of breath when he jumped right into my arms. So I held him up off the ground, and danced him around and around, with many hugs and kisses, whilst I was trying to shake the hand of my priestly brother, Thomas, and hug him too. What I remember most was being absolutely delighted, because George was so pleased to see me. It was a happy time. Everywhere men were beaming at each other and shaking hands, and everyone was talking to everyone else at the same time.
It's good to see you, young man. I've missed you. I truly have. And you too, Thomas. You're both a good sight for these tired eyes. And by God, George, I think you've grown bigger. Good on you, my boy. Good on you.
I began to get things underway after things settled down a bit. Apostos, Harold and Geoffrey listened intently, and I kept my arm around George whilst I explained to Thomas and my sergeants what needed to be done and why. Thomas, I'll explain later. But we need to get as many of these galleys as possible resupplied and turned around and started back to Cyprus as soon as they can be made ready. And they must go out with as many archers and men-at-arms as you can safely spare. Harold will be in command as the fleet's master sergeant. I'll be staying in Cornwall a while longer, at least until next spring, and maybe even longer. I continued after a pause, whilst I motioned Helen to come down from the galley, where she'd been quietly waiting to join us. Oh, and Apostos, a couple of these galleys need significant repairs, and one of them probably should be pulled ashore immediately before it sinks. The one over there, where the men are still bailing. But once you get it ashore, I want you to ignore it. Concentrate your men on repairing those needing minor repairs, so that Harold can take them back to Cyprus as soon as possible. Helen's walking up behind me, caused a bit of a stir. Most of the sergeant captains who sailed here with me had seen her, but Thomas and George didn't know about her at all.
George? Thomas? Everyone. This is Helen. She's my, she's with me. All afternoon, our horse carts, some pulled by horses and others by men, mustered for the purpose, moved back and forth between the boat camp and Restormor, carrying coin chests and various of Helen's purchases and other things up to the castle, returning with amphora jars full of oil and sacks of corn to feed the men on the galleys. Thomas moved quickly, and after a short delay, cattle and sheep began being driven into the boat camp to be slaughtered, so the newly arrived men could eat their fill and regain their strength. Geese and ducks and chickens arrived as well, and fires sprang up everywhere to burn the meat and cook flatbread. It had been a long voyage without proper meat, and the men did well at Almeria and Cadiz. They earned it all. Later in the afternoon, the archers marched up to the castle and enjoyed a second feast. They'll stay at Restormor until the galleys are ready to return to Cyprus. The sailors will stay here at the camp. Later, after the sun finished passing overhead, there was a real dinner at Restormor's Great Hall, for George and the boys, Helen, all the senior sergeants, and a couple of Augustinian priests who said they were passing through on their way to hold services at Launceston Priory, or join it, I'm not sure which. The priests probably stopped here for a last good meal before walking on to the priory. Tonight it was venison, ox joints, and suet pudding. The talk was merry, and the boys were in awe of Helen, and spent most of the evening playing throw-fingers games with her. The newly arrived sergeants, captaining the galleys, were mostly just in awe. They'd never been in a great hall before, let alone supped in one, as members of its lord's entourage. And I am a lord, even though I still find it hard to believe, and a lot of people still aren't sure. I may have been born a serf, but I bought my title fair and square, with the coins we took off the thieving bishop who tried to murder us. So here I am, by the grace of God and a couple of bloody knives. Thomas and I finally had an opportunity to share some ale and talk without anyone else around to listen. Later in the evening, when the sergeants were gone off to their beds, we waited until George and the boys were in bed and a place had been found for Helen and me. Once we were alone, I brought Thomas up to date about Constantinople and our affairs in the East, and explained why we needed to send all our available galleys and men to Cyprus as soon as possible. He laughed uproariously when I told him how Helen arrived as a gift from the merchants, and a very fine one indeed, he agreed. Then Thomas got serious and leaned forward over his bowl of ale. "Trouble is brewing, little brother. Big trouble. One of the Germans who claims to be the Holy Roman Emperor is holding Richard for ransom. A big ransom. We've received parchments from the church and Longchamp ordering us to help pay it, and parchments from both Prince John and his man in London ordering us not to provide a single coin. We don't owe anything to Richard, or to the church, or Longchamp," was my irate response. "Don't give them a single copper. Not one." "Of course not. I'm not that daft, am I? I told them we'd already spent all our coins, by either giving them to the Pope for his prayers, or using them to pay sailors and fighting men to rescue Christians fleeing the Saracens, and reminded them Cornwall is so poor, even the Romans didn't build a road to it." Thomas smiled as he thought about how to tell me what he'd done. He was obviously proud of himself and was going to enjoy the telling of his tale. Then he laughed out loud and continued. "What I did, my dear little brother, was send a parchment to each of them, reminding them Cornwall is mostly a home for fishermen, and except for the tin mines, whose revenues all go to the crown, it produces no revenues because its lands are so poor and sparsely populated. It has, I pointed out to each of them, only a handful of monasteries, and a few poor churches whose lands are so poor they can't support a priest. To placate John, I added in your name a commitment not to send a single coin for Richard's ransom. To placate Richard, I told Longchamp and the nuncio you had recently impoverished yourself by sending all the coins you'd taken from the heathen pirates directly to the Pope at the request of his papal nuncio in Cyprus. I also told them you had pressed Cornwall's tin miners to produce more tin and tin revenues for the realm." "Did we really do some of that?" I asked Thomas, a bit incredulously.
Well, not really, but it sounded good, don't you think? Actually, I did tell the overseers of the tin mines to increase their output, at the same time I told them they had to free their slaves. But of course, I didn't send any coins to the Pope or anyone else in your name. I'm not daft, am I? The Pope would probably never see them, and if he did, he'd just piss them away on his entertainments and women.
Thomas continued, after a pause for a sip of ale.
I don't think we have anything to worry about. Longchamp and the Pope's man won't know you didn't send your coins to the Pope, and they'll not be able to ask him or the Cyprus Nuncio, will they? Or will they? It's a pity we're not the ones carrying parchments and peoples between London and the East. William, we'd know who was saying what, and to whom, if our galleys and cogs were the ones carrying the parchments and messengers between London and Rome. Maybe we should be posting some of our galleys and cogs in London and Rome, instead of stationing most of them in the Holy Land or here. What do you think?
The sun shining in my eyes, and the calls of the roosters woke me up the next morning. Restormore was a huge castle with a splendid stone keep, consisting of three perfectly rounded rooms, stacked on top of each other, and a fine stone staircase connecting the top two rooms to the great hall below them. And, of course, we have a cellar extending under the great hall and part of the bailey. That's where our food supplies are stored, and there are cells for the keeping of people we consider to be felons and such. The top floor is where the coin and treasure chests are stored, and where we keep extra bales of arrows and other weapons in case of a siege. Thomas and the boys sleep on string beds on the second floor. Helen and I pushed aside some of the coin chests and had our string bed and such carried up to the coin room from Harold's galley. It was quite comfy. We had our own string bed in a cheery corner, and a piss pot all to ourselves, with two archer slits to let in the sun. There are even wooden plugs we can put into the slits to keep out the cold and the dangerous night air. But best of all, at least according to Helen, an old leather galley sail has been hung to divide the room and give us some privacy if someone comes for coins or weapons. Helen is quite peculiar about our privacy and accommodations. Yes, she is. Even before we went to sleep last night, she asked if a shite pot was available and put some of the carpet she fetched from Constantinople on the floor stones to hide their cold from our feet. Helen gave the sweetest little snore as I rolled off the bed, rubbed my eyes, scratched my bollocks to bother the lice, and thought about putting on my chainmail. I think not. Here I'm safe, even if I don't wear it. So I gathered up my clothes from where I threw them last night when Helen got playful, hoisted my bollocks and dingo into my coppies, slipped on my leather shoes and pants, and put my tunic back on without my chainmail under it. Whilst I was getting dressed, I could hear the boys whispering and giggling in the room below, and couldn't keep myself from smiling. It's a wonderful morning, and I'm so glad to be back with all the comforts and pleasures of home. Helen's still asleep, so I think I'll piss and shite outside this morning, so as not to wake her. And who would ever have thought I'd be the lord of such a fine place, without even having to buy the Pope's prayers and such to get it? All Thomas and I had to do was kill the thieving bishop who tried to murder us and start using his coins. Then one thing led to another, and here we are. So down the stairs and out the door I went, and then I walked through the bailey and climbed the three steps to the stone chute in the curtain wall. That's where Thomas insists everyone inside the walls piss and shite. It's a useless bother, of course, but it makes him happy. It's probably why the moat is so slimy and the fish tastes so bad. Harold was just coming down the stairs from the shite hole as I was climbing up.
"How do things look?"
I asked as I continued on up to take a desperately needed piss. I looked over my shoulder at him whilst he answered, "Some things wait for no man."
"Well, we've already got more than enough supplies and livestock off the manors to feed ourselves on the way back to Cyprus. The problem is, we've only 5 usable galleys, and maybe a couple more if we have a week or two to cook them. But that's about it. William Forrester's galley came in with a badly cracked rib just off the keel. He's lucky it didn't give way and sink out from under him."
"What about the training galleys, or those off to London? What shape are they in? Can you take them and leave some of the three being repaired for training and recruiting? Later in the morning, Harold and Thomas and I talked about many such important matters as we walked down the muddy cart path to the boat camp. What I heard was very encouraging. We had many more new archers in camp than I'd expected, almost 250 who were thought to be good enough with longbows to be sent out to Cyprus for Urim and Henry to use. Even if we took them all, it would leave well over 100 partially trained apprentices here to guard the place whilst their arms are getting stronger and they finish their training.
My God, Thomas, no wonder a Stormwall seems to be crawling with archers.
It is. We must have over 700 of them here, if the veterans who just came in on our galleys are included. Harold reminded me of even more.
Don't forget, there are also a couple of archers from among the slaves we freed from the Cadi's galleys, and 30 or 40 more who will probably sign up to train as apprentice archers. If the past is any guide, maybe more if we push them.
Freed galley slaves make good archers if they're still healthy. They've got strong arms from all the rowing, don't they? It seems word has gotten out about our company being a good company for archers and would-be archers to join. According to what Thomas told me last night, we're getting more and more men who show up, wanting to join us as apprentice archers. Some are walking for days to get here, and more may be on the way. As I was told last night, whilst we were supping, the weather was good a few days ago, so one of the cogs, the little one with a short mast, went off to London to pick up any men and boys our recruiting parties might have sent to the ports along the way. According to Thomas, it should be back any day now.
Well, I told Harold, plan on all the seaworthy galleys leaving as soon as possible. We're not going to wait for the galleys needing repairs. They can come out on their own later.
It's usually safe for war galleys to travel alone, particularly ours. The pirates are looking for undefended cargo transports with valuable cargoes and sailors to seize, not galleys full of archers to fight, or no gain in the unlikely event they win. Later, that warm, sunny morning, I was walking back from the boat camp when I got to thinking about all the troubles and fighting we had last year, and the troubles I'd heard about here in England. For some reason, I suddenly became very uneasy, almost worried, about the future and my plan to send our archers back to Cyprus. I began to think Thomas and I should somehow change our plans. Perhaps send some, and maybe even all of our new apprentice archers out to Henry on Cyprus for their training, and keep more of the experienced archers here for our protection. Maybe all of them. By the time I crossed the drawbridge and headed for the cook shed, a misting drizzle had started, and I'd reached a decision as to what to do. I'm going to keep almost all the archers and archer apprentices here over the winter and intensify their training. And my head is so addled with thinking that I don't watch where I'm stepping and almost take a fall. The stones in the courtyard are certainly slick. And that's what I told Thomas. Thomas, I've been doing some thinking, and I think we need to change our plans. I'm concerned about the murderous lady, or whatever she is. Alicia, Baldwin's wife. Think about it. She's a countess, living a good life right here in Restormwall Castle with Baldwin. And she gets him to attack her widowed sister and nieces in Bosinney Castle, so he can evict them and add Bosinney to their holdings. Then, after we killed Baldwin and took Restormwall, she betrothed herself to Baldwin's cousin, Fiscon of Launceston. And she goes right back after her sister and her little nieces once again. And this time, she's able to get them killed before we can finish off Fiscon and add his keep at Launceston to our holdings. Thomas nodded his head in agreement and motioned for me to continue. I'm pretty sure Thomas knows where I'm going with this, but he wants to hear me say it. Alicia's totally mad, isn't she? So what worries me is not knowing what she's going to do next. Will she be satisfied now that her sister and nieces are dead? I hope so, but it's starting to worry me because we don't know where she is or what she's doing. So I've made up my mind. I'm going to send our new and totally untrained men out to Cyprus and keep all of our archers and apprentice archers and all the men Henry trained to use the new bladed pikes here with us in Cornwall. We can replace the archers on the Cyprus-bound galleys with the new recruits. Henry can learn them to be archers in Cyprus, and the archers who haven't been through Henry's pike training can be learnt how to walk together and use the new pikes here instead of from Henry on Cyprus. We brought almost all of our new bladed pikes to England from Cyprus because we don't need them on the galleys, and it's not likely we'll need them in the Holy Land. If we have to fight out there, it's likely we'll be fighting on our ships or behind our walls rather than facing charging knights. It's here in Cornwall, marching to fight an invader, is where we're likely to be caught out in the open and need them.
I agree with you, William. I really do. You're right that we need to stay strong here in Cornwall.
What with that devil woman probably wanting Restormall and Launceston back, and all the kings and would-be kings arguing and fighting about who should pay for their ransoms and wars.
I'm glad to hear you agree, Thomas. I really am. Besides, the archers won't be needed on our galleys if all we're going to do is carry refugees. No one wants to chance a fight with one of our galleys. They know it's not likely to be carrying anything of value, and might well have some of our archers and longbows on board to take them instead of the other way around.
Then Thomas smiled and added something to which I could only smile back and nod my head to show my agreement.
And most of all, I'm glad you're going to keep the archers here, because keeping George safe and learning him and the boys to scribe and sum is much more important than earning a few more coins in the Holy Land. It's the only way our plan can succeed. We've already got coins in our chests to last us quite some time. Many years, actually.
Later in the afternoon, Thomas and I stood on the bank of the river and waved farewell as the first of our galleys rowed down the river heading for Cyprus, with a crew of sailors and 6 dozen or so of our new recruits and former slaves doing the rowing, and then watched in amazement a few hours later when it came right back up the river, towing one of our cogs coming in from London with almost 100 new recruits and an important rumour. Towing the cog and its news and archer recruits up the river to us before heading across the channel to France and on to Cyprus was a right good decision by the cog sergeant captain, Alexander, the archer sergeant from Hassox, who used to be a smith's apprentice. That's for sure. So I went on board and told him so in front of his men. He was very pleased. Chapter 2. A Question of Danger.
Richard has been ransomed, and he might be coming to England. Can the rumour be true? Will there be a war between him and John, do you think?
That's what I asked Thomas, as I kept waving my hand in a useless effort to drive away the swarm of biting bugs buzzing around my face. The day was warm, and the sun was finishing its pass overhead, as we walked up the cart path back up to Restormall to eat in the Great Hall. The path was still muddy from this morning's rain, and heavily rutted from all the supply wagons moving along it. I wonder why the bugs are only around the river, and come out so much just as the sun finishes passing overhead and goes down over the horizon. Of course, it could be true. They've been raising money for his ransom all year, and of course he'll come to England if it's paid. He's the king, isn't he? And it's been a long time since he's last been here. Besides, he needs to settle things with John.
I know that. Of course, I do. And it worries me, I said, with a rather ill-humoured tone to my voice, as I kicked a rock off the path. Then I asked the question that was really bothering me.
But what will it mean for John and for us if Richard comes to England? Do you think they'll fight? They are brothers after all. What I'm really asking Thomas is what he thinks will happen to the lands and keeps we took and the earldom we bought with so many of our coins. God only knows, but it probably won't be good. Days turn into weeks as our veterans drilled the new men on walking together and using their longbows and the new long-handled pikes with blades and hooks we were making on Cyprus. It was a grand summer made better by Helen's happiness at discovering I had no wife. Then word came in from the sailor sergeant of one of our cogs, which comes in from London with a load of wheat and salt for our siege reserves. He saw a ship with Richard's flag at the next wharf, whilst he was boarding some new recruits and taking on amphoras of salt and the sacks of the corn we'd been buying to build up our siege reserves. We know how important...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?